Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
So as many of you clearly know by now, I love comics. And I actually host another podcast, Quarantine Comics, where ace reporter and longtime friend of the pod, Ryan Joe, and I read comics and reflect on how they make us feel. And comics can be so much more than just superheroes and sci-fi. Like film, TV, and even podcasts, there are so many stories and genres that can move you and show perspectives that you might not normally have access to. Sound familiar? It should, because it's what we strive to do on this very Modern Minorities podcast. Share minority perspectives for all of our majority ears. That's why I'm really excited to share this chat that Ryan and I had about the graphic novel Carrie, the debut comics work by Amrita Patel. Carrie tells the story of a lesbian 20-something Indian professional in the hustle and bustle of modern India. It's a deeply moving work that gave us pause and reflection across many topics. We can't recommend this book enough. So check out our Quarantine Comics chat and be sure to pick up a copy of Carrie wherever you get your favorite books.
Dark in the city, night is a wire. Steam in the subway, earth is a fire. Do, 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 do. Woman, you want me, give me a sign. And catch my breathing even closer behind. Do, 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 do. I'm on the hunt, I'm after you. I smell like I sound, I'm lost in a crowd. And I'm hungry like the wolf. I straddle the line, it is gonna rhyme.
So Ryan, we've got to know each other professionally and personally over the years.
That is very true. I remember meeting at the Cannes Advertising Festival nearly a decade ago.
I've always wondered your thoughts on the advertising industry.
I don't think you've ever wondered that, Ruman. But I will tell you, a wretched hive of scum and villainy.
Are we talking about the ad industry or can?
Yes.
Well, Ryan, have you ever wondered what it's like to be a female South Asian queer advertising writer working on women's hair care products, living in a big and bustling smog city, crammed into an apartment with several single women, while also queer and saddled with a sense of regret and ennui?
I wonder about that early and often every day, Ruman. But I will tell you, I can relate to at least two of those things. What about you?
Well, I can relate to at least two of those things, but something tells me we are not talking about the same two things.
What do you mean, not the same two things? I thought the things that brought us together on this podcast was our intimate knowledge of hair care products.
Which I actually did work on for the better part of half a decade. I actually thought it was our mutual sense of regret and ennui.
But is it regret and ennui about the same things?
I'm Roman Segal.
I'm Ryan Joe.
And we are two dudes who are pretty sure our semi-urban existences are less of a dark and emo indie comic book and more of a sad reality show where we're both waiting to be voted off the island.
Oh, that really does suck, Roman. Speak for yourself.
This week, we continue our courageous comics caravan through the alphabet, and we have arrived on the letter K to read Carrie, the 2008 debut Indian graphic novel by Amrita Patel, who's since gone on to become a leading voice in the Indian comic scene, illustrating a number of projects, including a reimagining of the Hindu epic, the Mahabharata. In Carrie, we meet the eponymous protagonist upon her surviving a heartbroken suicide attempt, and we follow her to work and at home in the hustle and bustle of Smog City. A marketing and advertising exec who turns her creative eye on the world and herself, she lives a semi-closeted queer life, living with many single women, befriending or romantically rebounding with a business colleague with weeks left to live, and just surviving in a monsoon-drenched city. In deeply drawn black and white chapters, we journey through Carrie's crowded loneliness, sleeper success, and death, all in the shadow of her departed partner. The book is a sensuous yet wry commentary on life and love. So in my research on the Indian graphic novel scene, this book kept coming up and was unlike anything I'd ever seen. So naturally, I've been looking for an excuse to read it. Ryan, I have a lot of thoughts about this book, but before I unpack my own baggage, how did you actually find it?
I found it because you told me about it. But to answer your real question, Raman, which is not that, I really liked it. And there's a...
Episode over.
There's this wonderful dreamlike quality throughout the entire book. Even though it's also very gritty and deals with this character's depression and the way she navigates this world, it's actually really difficult for me to articulate why I like this book so much. But it felt like I was sort of cast into the sort of dream of modern day India, even though I don't think that's quite accurate, because she's dealing with very real world concerns around her roommates who are like all over the place all the time, real world concerns about her job, real world concerns about her mortality. But I really like the lens through which Kari views all of these things. It's a strange journey that the book puts you through.
Yeah, I like what you say. I think you said dreamlike, because I read it over the course of like 3 or 4 nights, because they're really heavy chapters. It's a super thin book, but the chapters are thick. Like, it's like reading poetry. Not that the words are poetry, but like a good poem could be like 20 lines and it can take you 30 minutes to really sit with it, right? And every chapter for me over those 3 nights of reading sat with me and felt like a recurring dream, you know? Like, it's like you keep coming back into this universe and dipping into it. Yeah, I couldn't stop thinking about it after reading it for a week. And it's actually because of delays and scheduling stuff. It's been about 2 weeks since I read it. And so resetting my brain to come back into it. And yeah, it's I after finishing reading it the last night, I think I texted you. I decided to go downstairs and like look up interviews with the author and understand what else she's written. And how autobiographical is this? Just like, it doesn't hit too close to home, but it's almost too real, even though it's too surreal at the same time.
I mean, just talking about the writing. So a lot of it is also sort of, it almost feels at times like a novel with illustrations in certain part. And the writing is very, very evocative in a way that also creates a sort of dreamscape in the way the character Kari often sort of personifies certain things. Like, for instance, there's this line on page 34 where she envisions herself as a boatman, like going around cleaning up India, but also evokes Chiron, who is the boatman from the Greek myths who shepherds people off to the underworld when they die. In fact, her friend who is dying of cancer refers to her as the boatman. And so it creates this mythological sensibility around Kari, the person, and her position in this world. And there's one sequence where she was talking about how she was ferrying herself through India, trying to clean it up through... Actually, what city is this? Is this Mumbai?
It's obviously supposed to be Mumbai, but she doesn't say, right? It's an amalgam of India.
She's basically ferrying her way through the flooded city, through the filth of the flooded city, trying to clean it up. And then at the end, she takes a shower. And the way it's described, she says, "Washing the stench off my body when I get back home is a ritual. I can see the stench, eager as mercury, rushing into the drain hole to join the mother bog." And that's just like just such a wonderful and evocative way of describing the way the stench washes off of her, personifying this, it almost like it's a creature that's rushing off to join its mother. And I feel like the writing itself just has that sort of evocative nature. It just really creates a wonderful dreamscape, even without the pictures.
Yeah, it's very singular. It's about this one woman's view of her world and the world, but it taps onto these broader themes. And some of it, I think you said at the top, is it about modern India? I mean, I guess and no. Like, it came out of India. And maybe there's some things that are specifically India, but it just feels like this modern life. And maybe something that is very India specific is, we're recording this, it's the middle of Pride Month, and someone from some network I'm part of talked about like stats of queer perception in the West versus the East, and the laws that have been passed and decriminalization of homosexuality, etc. And regardless of where like the political structures are of queer existence in Asia, societally, it's like looked down on. And I say this, like, this is in that society. Like, here we can have pride parades down the street. You don't do that in India and China. In fact, there's chapters in this book where there's most people, I don't think, realize that Carrie is queer. And people come at her saying, oh, you just haven't met the right man. And there's a lot of that. And she just rolls her eyes. And she's living with a bunch of other single women who are bringing boyfriends in and out of their apartment. And I guess maybe that's arguably that's probably the most specific Indian thing in the book is what I found. And I'm by no means an expert on Indian society or Indian culture, but I just found it striking. Like this, I don't think this book could be written in America for a lot of reasons.
Look, the interesting thing about Carrie also, like, she's just really wonderfully defiant. Yeah. And she's also in an interesting position because she's both very much exists within the world. She's both an outcast because that's how she feels, as she's sort of watching her roommates do whatever it is they do. But at the same time, she's not an entire outcast. She's definitely able to have like really meaningful or interesting interactions with the people who surround her. Like they're going clubbing and she feels a little awkward because they try to, there's this other single boy. Maybe they're trying to set her up with him. And obviously there's no sparks flying there, but then she goes to the bathroom and she has like a great sexual encounter in the bathroom. And so it's she's not like entirely.
It's very underground. It's very underground in India, I think.
What, in terms of her sexuality or the way the...
I think so. It's a known thing that exists and it's tolerated, but it's like...
But she's very but she's also very comfortable about it. Like she doesn't... Mm-hmm. It's something that she doesn't seem to go out of her way to hide at all. It's just that nobody seems to notice it.
Or acknowledge that it exists.
Right. Yeah. It's unclear whether the people around her don't know or just don't think about it, or just it's just something that just doesn't pass across their minds, or if they're just they know and they're ignoring it. And I'd actually be curious what you think about that.
I think that checks out with what modern Asia is like. Now, to be fair, this book was written in 2008. And I mean, a cliche about Asia is the amount of change that happens in 10 or 15 years, just as the amount of change that happens in 50 to 100 years in the West. Yeah. So who knows what the norms are today. But I mean, to publish a book this much about it, it's not specifically Indian, but there's some very specific Indian things in it. And I was talking to...
I want to just push you on. What were the specific Indian things? Because this is... Obviously, you're much more familiar with India and Indian culture than I am. What leapt out to you?
India has a feel, and I've only been three times in my life, but you see it in films, in movies, and pop culture, and I can tell what's authentically Indian and what's not in culture because the touch, the feel, the smell of it. And this has that. It just does. Like the things, the manner of the streets, the manner of the... I don't want to say the pollution, the way aunties and uncles talk, the way men and women talk to each other. But then on the flip side, I worked for about a year in Southeast Asia in Singapore with a lot of marketing and business executives. And that's Carrie's other life, right? And so much of that just rang true. It wasn't the American corporate experience or the American advertising industry experience. It was the Asian advertising industry experience. So it's just like little details that obviously authentically written by someone who's lived in this existence just really popped out. I could like see those rooms. I could see those conference rooms. I could see those apartments. I could see those streets. The cleaning lady who comes in every day and nurses after these young women, the Ganesh festival. These are all just very hyper-specific things that are authentically portrayed, in my opinion. And then with the darkness on top of it, that is this novel.
I was actually really fascinated by the three women, besides Carrie, the three, I guess, supporting female characters who dominate her life. One is her girlfriend, who only shows up really for like two pages, I think. And then the other two, of course, are her two female roommates. And of course, there are two guys that they are sleeping with. But it's interesting. Those two dudes just like recede into the background. But those three women are really vivid and they have like really distinct personalities. And I was just impressed with the way they were characterized in such a distinct way, but without a lot of quote unquote screen time. Did they leave an impression on you too?
Not really. So I haven't watched I haven't watched the show Girls other than like one or two episodes and all the press coverage of it. And so that might be it's a bunch of people shacked up in an apartment in Brooklyn together, except it's Smog City, or which is probably Mumbai. That was just the vibe I got off of it. They didn't really jump out at me. To me, they were not background characters at best, because the dynamic of both of their boyfriends, they used to have opposite boyfriends. Like they dated, they've all not quite incestuously, but all dated each other. It was just a construct in the gimmick of her home life, which is absolutely a setting of her life. There's the office, there's her new girlfriend, the woman who's dying, there's the interactions and social life with her roommates. I mean, those are the three main set pieces, but it didn't really leave as much a mark on me. If anything, the thing that left a mark on me wasn't the girls themselves, but the time that she goes out with the girls, or the way their maid treats her versus the other girls, the way the other mothers treat her versus the other girls. So it was always in contrast to the other girls.
I guess maybe that's, I do that as part of it, right? Even it's not just about the way those two girls interact with Carrie, but also the way that the world views those other girls who are more conventionally attractive, are straight, versus Carrie, who doesn't really give a shit about her appearance, who is almost sort of self-loathing, but who has this incredibly, who's quiet on the outside, but who has this incredibly rich inner life. And the way that she is sort of viewed, almost like she's invisible. I think like it's like the world almost treats her as...
Yeah. She's just navigating through and commenting. Not commenting, but like you're watching her mental critique of the world.
Yeah.
As she just floats through it.
And there's this line earlier where she's talking about her roommates and the way that they interact with her, as if she's just completely harmless, which like speaks to the fact that they view her as sort of like this interesting pet.
Yeah. She's an anomaly, right? And maybe their token queer friend, even though it's never truly addressed that if all of her friends know this about her. I think her work buddy, Lazarus, and obviously the dying girlfriend are the only two people who know who Carrie is.
But they're the only ones who have any real interactions with her.
Yeah, meaningful ones, for sure. Because her apartment is just where she lives and she goes to sleep, right?
That being said, though, I do like the fact that she calls it the Crystal Palace. I mean, we talked about the fairy tale aspect of the dreamlike fairy tale aspect of this graphic novel. The way she sort of characterizes the settings, even though it might be a smoggy, overcrowded one-bedroom apartment, yet she calls it the Crystal Palace. And it's interesting, the first time she depicts it, the first time you see her... It's just actually this sort of like this collage, this full color collage of these women in these pink dresses. So it's an image that befits the name Crystal Palace. And then, of course, later on, you see that it's a shitty one bedroom and everyone is back to black and white and everything is sort of like cramped and crowded and gray hued. It's actually kind of interesting because she had this view of what it would be like to live with these women initially, and then when she actually meets them, she's completely disillusioned. And I think the initial introduction of the so-called Crystal Palace with this beautiful full-colored illustration, this collage, and then that like is the anticipation of what Carrie is going to get. And then of course you see the floor plan of this thing and you're like, and everyone's sleeping on the floor and you're like, okay, so that's what she actually gets.
It's so interesting. Like, India is this place that's known to me but distant to me. Like, I've only been there three times in my life, 6, early 20s, late 20s. I've not been back since as a true adult married with kids, and it's something I want to do. But my time in Singapore is when I really got to know Indian professionals. Like, people, the Indians I knew were always my parents' generation, right? The uncles and aunties. And it wasn't until I worked in Southeast Asia where I got to know people my age who had interests and slept around and went to shows and drank and blah, blah, blah. And I just find that fascination with the youth culture of India, and without ruining anything about a movie that I'm encouraging you to go see, there's something about youth culture in India there. And I just find this like pride and fascination with it. And I don't think I'll ever get to experience it because I'm a grown up, I'm an adult, I'm an old man now. And so I can only observe it through literature. And because I hate to say it, the pop culture of Bollywood and Tollywood aren't going to show it to you. It exists in things like this. And that's one, I think the bias of my lack of being Indian, but being Indian is another thing that drew me into this book.
Do you regret that, not having experienced that sort of authentic Indian youth culture?
No, I mean, yes and no. Like, I mean, I have cousins there, but I'm just not close with them, and they're my age now, right? That were married with kids. My briefest moment interacting was being a professional in the marketing and advertising industry, where some people were working on hair care products, like, and laundry care products. But I got to know those people, and I'm still in touch with a few of those people. I don't think it's a regret. It's just, regret's the wrong word, but it is something I wish I knew better, right? Like, I'm okay not being as Indian and Indian American, right, as I could be, but I think I'd probably like gel more with these Indians than with the Indian Americans that I don't gel with, if that makes sense. Even though I'm like defiantly an American, and I'm okay with it.
But didn't you have like your wild 20s period going through college and through the years directly after college when you're just roaming the city like a starving wolf?
I wish I could recite some of the lyrics of the Duran Duran song right now, but I can't. I don't know, man. Like, this is the problem with episodes about books that we both like, and me not being a reporter and knowing how to ask questions of you.
That's good questions. That's like your entire podcast thing. You ask good questions of CEOs, of modern minorities.
But not my friends, but not some of my closest friends. No. I don't know, man. Like, is there anything you didn't like about this book? Like, I mean, I have some minor things, but I'm just curious, like, what didn't make sense about this to you?
I wasn't sure the attraction between her and Ruth. And I wasn't sure...
Ruth
is the woman who's had a failed suicide attempt. Because
that's
where everything starts, right? So Ruth, they have this relationship that you don't really see articulated except for one scene. And then... one day, Carrie sees Ruth on the rooftop, and Carrie's on the opposite, on the building on the opposite side, and then Ruth jumps. And Carrie reflexively jumps too, and Ruth ends up in a safety net, so she's fine, and then Carrie, she's saved because she lands in, like, filthy water. And then Ruth leaves, and that interaction is what sort of begins the book, and you're meant to think, okay, so this failed suicide attempt is what's going to define Carrie throughout the rest of the novel.
And I think worth noting something, the end of the book closes on a page that says to be continued.
Right.
So in the Quarantine Comics tradition of reading one book that will eventually have a sequel in like 10 to 20 years, this book joins that pantheon. The second book, and I've read and listened to a few interviews with Amrita Patel, the creator, then the bookend of this series is going to be the story from Ruth's perspective. But...
Right. So I can only speak to like what's in this first volume, which is from Carrie's perspective. And that was something that I was quite, and maybe it'll be answered in book two. I don't know, but.
Well, this is where I was going to go. I think the nature of their fall is maybe like a metaphor for the existence and the theme of the book, because Carrie, she falls into the bog, into like the fucking filthy water of Smog City.
Yeah.
And it feels like that's what she's swimming through the whole book. And there is an allusion, I believe, to Ruth early on in the book where Ruth winds up getting on a net, safety net, getting on a plane and going to the west.
Right.
Yeah. And the net, it catches her and takes her away from the Smog City that is India, so to speak. So I actually do think like the way they land or in the way they both survive is two very different things. She's stuck in it, Carrie.
Yes, I agree. Thematically, it's cool. But from a character standpoint, that's the one thing I'm missing is like, you have these two characters who, Ruth made a big impression on Carrie. I mean, why else would Carrie jump when Ruth jumps? But after that, Ruth seems to disappear. And I was looking for some resonance, I guess you can say that Carrie is obsessed with death. She like seeks out that cancer patient client. But I was still sort of missing the why or what was Carrie looking for? What did she want? What does she want? And how does this failed suicide attempt impact or affect her desires? I guess maybe that's what I'm missing, is a sense of what Carrie was looking for. And because of that, It felt there was like a lack of like dramatic urgency to everything that was happening. And maybe that's also why I fixated on some of the supporting characters, because I could understand more what they want and where they're coming from. And Carrie is a little bit oblique to me.
But for me, it's, I like the J.J. Abrams mystery box.
What is the J.J. Abrams mystery box?
So he gives a TED talk about, it's the frustration everyone has with Lost. What's the smoke monster? Where's the polar bear from? Like, I actually don't need to know this. Like, I appreciate not knowing it because it lets me try to fill in the blanks and wonder. Yes. Because I don't think any answer Amrita Patel could give me that answers your question would be good enough. And it's actually better to not know, because you just, it's not that you're even filling in the blanks. It's just, it's such a big, deep mystery that actually paints a cloud over the whole fucking book that you don't understand this thing.
Yes and no. One of my favorite novels is The House of Leaves, which is about a haunted house. And we never, we know how weird the house is, but we never know why it is the way it is. And the book poses a lot of questions, but you sort of know throughout the book that you're not going to get an answer. And I feel like if you structure the book like there is going to be an answer, you get the audience expecting an answer, and then you don't give them an answer, I feel like the audience is going to feel cheated. Actually, Sherman Alexie wrote a novel, a mystery novel, where he never solved it. And in an interview, he's like, I probably should have given a solution to that, because in the beginning, I was like, I was going to give a standard mystery novel. And in a standard mystery novel, there is an answer. You're telling the audience that there's going to be an answer. And when you don't give it to them, they feel cheated. And I feel actually J.J. Abrams did that, because like Lost, promises answers. If you work with me, we're going to get to the bottom of it. And when he doesn't give it to you, when he promises, you feel fucked. And so that's why I agree and disagree with the whole mystery box concept that you just set, that you just talked about, because it depends on how you set it up.
No, but no promises were made. You're assuming a promise was made, and
hold on a second. The promise, it's never like the author's going to be like, and I'm going to solve it eventually, folks. Like, it's never going to be that explicit. But if you, for instance, begin the book as a standard mystery novel, and you continue down that path, and the character is working through clues like he's going to get to it, then there's this expectation that indeed the mystery will be solved. And if you don't do that, you're going to really piss off the audience. Now, on the other hand,
I just think that's mainstream, what the mainstream audiences want. And I used to get really frustrated trying to read Italo Calvino. And again, when I just fucking let go that I'm not going to understand what the fuck I'm reading.
Italo Calvino does not at all set up any expectation of a pat answer. Like, he's a good contrast. Like, Italo Calvino, like, his shit is off, like, laced in fairy tale stuff, like Carrie. So he's not setting this expectation that, like all of these cities are going to have, like, oh, If on a Winter Night's a Traveler, you pretty much early on that shit is not going to have a pat conclusion, because
No, you don't. If you come in it from a, like, a mainstream appeal, like, the first time I read that book, it's like a Terrence Malick movie. Like, if you come into it thinking it's going to be an ABC, here you go, bing, bang, boom. It's like, you are going to be sorely disappointed. And sometimes the first time someone's like, you need to read this. Yeah, so I don't buy that.
David Lynch, you watch the movie. This is not going to have an easy conclusion. A Dan Brown story. Right. Why is that?
Because the chapters are so short, I feel so smart as I'm reading through it.
Right, but as you're flipping through a Dan Brown story, right? I mean, there's something in the writing. There's something in the way that story is being told that tells you, oh, we're working towards a conclusion. And the conclusion will be revealed eventually, right? Like,
sure.
Versus when you read Italo Calvino, you read a couple of pages, the story stops, and then the new story begins. And you read a couple of pages, the story stops, and then a new story begins. And you realize, okay, this is not going to have any conclusion. This is where I have to go along with it. So that's what I mean. Like, the writers are training you how to read it. And if you're training them to do one thing, i.e. expect an answer, expect a conclusion, and then you don't give it to them, that's when the audience feels like the rug's been pulled out from them, and not in a good way. So that's my pushback. It's not like every story needs to have a conclusion and everything needs to be explained. It's you set the rules in the beginning, and if the rules indicate I'm going to have a conclusion, then you need to give it to them. But if the rules indicate, okay, this is going to be a complete dreamscape, it's going to be completely nuts, don't expect a conclusion, then yeah, don't expect a conclusion. But I think it's disingenuous to like set out and be like, we're going to do it. This is going to be a standard detective story with a conclusion at the end and the mystery will be solved. And then when you don't give it to them, be like, ah, but I'm just trying to subvert expectations. Hey, fuck you. No, you're not. You're just lazy. Sorry, rant over.
No, but like, and to be clear, I don't think this book is as guilty of that.
No, okay, sorry. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I guess, okay, so within the context of Carrie, the fact that it opens with, ah, our hearts are connected. We have this, and then you have the suicide. It's setting up, okay, this is going to be a big thing. This attempted suicide is the driving action of Carrie. And it's really not. Ruth is sort of mentioned occasionally, but ultimately it seems like she's sort of forgotten. And Carrie's life goes on. And maybe there's some sort of impact that I'm missing. But again, I just missed it.
So this is where I do wonder, and I couldn't tease this out of all my reading of Amrita. This isn't jazz hands. This is literally, there's something deeply personal about that opening moment. Some trauma of a loved one informs this. Because to your point, there's no delivery on it. It's just you enter on this thing that clearly is pivotal to the protagonist of the book, and then we just move on to the reflection of the life. If anything, it's just, this is the background, this is the table setting, I had a really bad breakup, now let's go shit on the world. And beautifully so, right? And to your point, that dissonance, I wonder if it's rooted in something of her, right? Maybe it's not a one-for-one existence of a breakup that happened, but it's like, something happened to you, for you to want to, like, just, you had to insert that at the front. It's not just a construct for book one and book two.
No, but that's my point. I just felt it was set up to be sort of like the driving action, the driving thing that motivates Carrie throughout. Like she's missing something. Maybe she's missing Ruth, or she's missing what Ruth represents, and she's going to seek that out throughout the book. Or it's going to just sort of inform her actions throughout the book. But I guess that's what I was missing. Because if you cut that part out, the book plays the same. And I don't think it should be that way, you know, because it's set up to be so pivotal. So that's my complaint, which is, yeah, I mean, I liked a lot. I liked pretty much everything about the book, but it's just, this is one area where I was just like baffled because it felt like an absence.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just ranting though. But maybe that's the point of this podcast.
Well, I have to ask, Ryan, I mean, would you recommend Carrie to someone?
Yeah, I would. It's just such an interesting read. It creates such an interesting vibe, and it transports you to this place that I've certainly never been, and you've never been there either. I think comics are just so powerful in transporting you in a way that movies aren't, because movies just keep charging forward, right?
You can't manipulate time.
I wouldn't say that's always the case, because there are certain movies that just sort of like, there are certain movies that just sort of like put you into this world, but I feel comics are just so much better at it because you can slow down and just wrap yourself in the panels. And I feel like Carrie does that. And it's not just the art, it's also the writing. Even just like the captions are just like so strongly written and so evocative. It's just she's slinging some really cool sentences. Is this a translation?
I don't know. I mean, the thing about India is, because we were colonized, English is as much a first language across the entire subcontinent. In fact, there's too many other Indian languages that English is a common denominator. So English could be the first way this was written, probably. I know it's been translated into many other things. What's interesting to me about this book is I've been researching like Indian graphic novels because I was looking for coverage on a specific topic, and I've read a ton of novels on the topic. And then in my search, like, there is a thriving comic book scene in India, just like there's a thriving, believe it or not, heavy metal scene in India, and an everything else scene. It's India. It's a very big country, and there's people with interests that aren't just all Bollywood. But I'd bought a bunch of books, Indian graphic novels, and Carrie was obviously made every list, and it just, for some reason, it was so intimidating. I never chose to read it, and I never chose to buy it. And I got a bunch of other ones, and they got the vibe of India, but they didn't really, like, speak to me as much. They weren't as beautiful. And I regret not being the first one I read. Maybe it's for the better, because had I read this first, everything else would have been complete garbage by comparison, and I wouldn't have given it a chance. But this book just really pulled me in a way I was not expecting. And the queer narrative, which I don't, as a straight man, I don't fully understand. And it wasn't even just about that, but it's just that perspective. It's just something, the modern Indian perspective, just the beauty of the writing. Anyway, long story short, I totally recommend it. I wish I had read it sooner, but I'm glad we read it for this.
When's the next book coming out?
I don't know. So, you know,
same time as Rusty Brown.
We should, like, do predictions on which one's going to come out first, like almost like an over under of all of the overdue sequels. But so upon reading, finishing it that night, I stayed up and I watched an interview with her, and I discovered she'd done one of the great Hindu epics is the Mahabharata. And she's done a really interesting reimagining. And I've been debating if I want to buy it or not, because I can only buy it directly from India, so it's not cheap. But again, as someone, I'm also obsessed with, like, world religion. This is something I want to read. And she went and made these books of the Mahabharata. She did some collaborations with some other comics writers. She's more of a full-time artist in India now, but in a lot of her interviews, she's talked about the bookend to Carrie. And so I don't know if she's working on it now or not. And she's one of those writers that we were talking about before we recorded. Like, I'm glad I have another podcast. I want to reach out to her. Yes, she's an Indian in India, but she is, I don't know if Amrita is queer or not, but she's a minority within India, right? So I really want to get to know her writing more and her art more, because I just find her fascinating. And what's interesting is everyone says Carrie has a very distinct look and feel versus her other work. So
is her other work more literal?
I don't know. No, it's not a literal retelling of the Mahabharata.
No. Literally, I mean, is her other work more literal? Because this feels very sort of evocative. And
I don't know. That's, again, I'm going to find out. Having a conversation about this with someone else for an hour makes me, like, I'm ready to, like, just click buy. Like, enough's enough.
All right. Are you going to do it? Are you going to do it on this podcast? Are you going to click buy on this? Yeah.
It is in my cart, so I could do it right now. Yeah. So why the hell not?
And what's the rest of the Indian graphic novel scene like? How would you describe it?
It's a gritty nature of how it reveals India. It's definitely, like, a lot of black and white and zine-y. So the original Indian comics scene, there's a couple things. One, which is more like Mickey Mouse type stuff, cartoony shit. And then there was a imprint called Amrachitrakata, which did basically retellings of all the religious stories of Hinduism. And that was my first, you ask any Indian person who likes comic books, they all read Amrachitrakata. In fact, that's informed my view on religion. And there's a Pixar artist who did a short about that. Like, you're reading Justice League and you're reading Amrachitrakata about Krishna and Ram and Hanuman at the same time. So that was, like, the dominant force. I've read a few essays on it now. And a lot of modern Indian comics, I guess similar to Carrie, that I've read are just about the modern existence. Not unlike some of the Japanese comics that we read. I can't remember the name of that movement, where it's just like, let's just talk about what life in Japan was like in the 60s, right?
Ah, like the Pushman, for instance.
Yeah. So there's a lot of that in the comics that I bought and read and been able to get access to. Because again, a lot of these comics aren't digitally available. I've been having to buy them on eBay or convince my library to get them. And to be fair, I've only read like five or six, the things that top the lists. But again, those other ones just feel a little too literal and not as dreamlike, not as artistic as Carrie was. And I'm hungering for this indie film vibe out of Indian comics, because I know it exists. I know it can be there.
What was the other Indian comic we read? Was it it was by Ram V. What was...
Well, yeah, so we never read Layla Starr on this podcast.
I did read Layla Starr. I did not.
I have as well.
I like Graffiti's Wall, but I didn't like Layla Starr.
Oh, that's right. We read Graffiti's Wall. We didn't read Layla. We both read Layla Starr, but not on this podcast.
We didn't talk about the other one.
Yeah, and then the other book we read was Krishna on this podcast. But that absolutely is like a beautiful religious retelling. It's not modern Indian comics about the Indian experience today.
What did you think of Graffiti's Wall? I was not on the podcast for that one.
Yeah, it was. good. It was fine.
It didn't have the same impact that Carrie did.
It didn't. And the friend I had the chat with was this kid, Amitosh, a very close friend's younger brother who I'm very close with. And he's just as removed from India as I am, more so. Like, he was born here. His mom is more Indian than mine is, but he's not been back. Right. So we just kind of read it as two youngsters talking about comics. It's interesting. One of the YouTube creators I follow, like I contribute money to him on Patreon. His name is Patrick H. Willems. And he actually just did a film essay on Bollywood, or actually not even Bollywood, Indian cinema. Cause it's not all relegated just to Mumbai. And there's just so much I don't know and understand about India. And it's not the obvious stuff. Like, it is a deep culture with people and interests in art. And there's a lot of it.
I mean, I feel that even if you lived there and grew up there and spent your entire childhood and adulthood there, there's probably a lot about India you still wouldn't know. It feels like...
Because it's on such a massive scale. I mean, you could make that statement about America, but I hate to say it.
Well, I mean,
but it's not that big. America's big.
I grew up in Modesto. I feel like I figured it out in 5 minutes.
No, I mean, it's America's big, but it's not that big. And that's the thing. And I've traveled. I've been to all 50 states. I know people all over this country, and I've lived in different parts of it. I feel like I know America, and most people outside of America know the different zones that we have. In India, you cross state lines and everything changes. Like, there's just, and the population is 4x the size of America, right? 1.x billion. So it's mind-boggling how little, to your point, there are people in India who don't fully know India just as much as there's people outside. But we outside of India, at least inside of India, they know everything is different everywhere. But here we create this monoculture of India that's not accurate at all.
That makes sense. Yeah, that is definitely true. I think a lot of the pop cultural exports, but also sort of the prejudices are sort of what inform our, the Western world's view of, well, not just India, but China and a whole bunch of other countries, especially ones that were once colonies.
Yeah. Well, hey, Ryan, I just did it. I did buy her new book.
Oh, he did live on Quarantine Comics. Roman buys something from Amazon.
Yeah, so it's the Parva Duology box set, Adi Parva and Saptik. It's funny, there's another thing from India that I bought recently. It's a book from India, but it was Osamu Tezuka, the famed grandfather or father of manga, who in late in life was a devout Buddhist, and he did a multi-volume series on the life of the Buddha series. And I remember something about reading an article about it, talking with someone about it, and looking it up on eBay, and it's like, wow, I'm about to buy this thing from India. And it's like the weirdest, like you buy something on Amazon here and it's coming from a warehouse in Kentucky or New Jersey. But to literally, I know I am pressing a button and the button has been pressed. Someone in India is going to get something and it's going to get wrapped up into a box and something from India is going to arrive in about 7 days. And that blows my mind still.
All right. Well, here, let me know when it arrives and we'll create a special Quarantine Comics episode.
Of the unboxing.
Of the unboxing. Exactly.
So, Ryan, I have a really important question that I got to ask you.
What is the question?
Well, what are we reading next week? Because now you're not going to know.
Well, I think we settled on Love and Rockets by the Hernandez brothers, right?
Here's what's funny about that. We did originally, and then you and I had a conversation about some book article that I sent you. And the last time we had this conversation after recording, you were like, throwing Love and Rockets under the bus for this other book. So is it Love and Rockets again?
What is the book that you mentioned? It was in Limbo, the Korean American girl's coming of age story.
Oh shit. I accidentally typed over it, but it's in there. Okay. In Limbo. So which one? I don't know. So,
okay. Well, we have to make a decision. Do we read Love and Rockets or do we read In Limbo? So what are,
why don't you just read something about both of them right now?
All right. So next week, what's the next letter? It's L. And we're going to read Love and Rockets by the Hernandez brothers. Now, Love and Rockets is an epic. It goes on forever. And we don't have all the time in the world. So we're going to actually be strategic and start at the beginning. We are going to read within the Love and Rockets universe. The first book, Maggie the Mechanic. I have no idea what it's about. Because I only know Love and Rockets by name, But what? We're going to find out next week. So stick with us. And
it's not next week. We don't read shit next week. Yeah. We're like a month behind.
So that's what we're going to read next.
Eventually. But next.
So stick with us. Love and Rockets, Maggie the Mechanic. That's for the next episode of Quarantine Comics. Okay. Yeah. So next week. So for our next episode, we are going to read In Limbo by Deb J.J. Lee. This is a debut graphic novel. It's about a Korean-American girl's coming of age in a New Jersey suburb, as well as Seoul. Really looking forward to it. It came out really recently, actually, just a few months ago. So it's a debut. It's a new book. And that's next time on Quarantine Comics.
We've been reading a lot of books about young women.
Well, fortunately, after that, for M, we're going to read a book about the Holocaust. So so that'll really perk you up, Raman.
That's what this podcast does to me. Perks me up.
And that's our show. Like what you heard? Be sure to share with a friend, subscribe, and leave us a review wherever you get your favorite podcasts. See lots of pretty pictures of books we read at qtdcomics.com. And since we're sure no one's listening, prove us otherwise. Shoot an email over to say what I got right and what Ryan got wrong. qtdcomics@gmail.com. Give you a social media handle, but we're old and that feels like too much work. I'm Roman Segal.
And I am and have always been Ryan Joe.
Night is a wire, steam in the subway, earth is a fire. Do, 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 do. Woman, you want me, give me a sign, and catch my breathing even closer behind. Do, 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 do. In touch with the ground, I'm on the hunt, I'm after you, I smell like I sound. I'm lost in a crowd, and I'm hungry like the wolf. I straddle the line in discarded rhyme. I'm on the hunt, I'm after you. My mouth is alive with juices like wine, and I'm hungry like the wolf. Too close to hide. I'll be upon you by the moonlight side. Do, 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 do. Well, high blood drumming on your skin, it's so tight. You feel my heat, I'm just a moment behind. Do, 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 do. Well, I'm in touch with the ground. I'm on the hunt, I'm after you. I smell like I'm lost in a crowd, and I'm hungry like the wolf. I straddle the line in discarded rhyme. I'm on the hunt, I'm after you. My mouth is alive with juices like wine, and I'm hungry like the wolf. I'm in touch with the ground. I'm on the hunt, I'm after you. I smell like I sound, and I'm lost in a crowd, and I'm hungry.
Potluck.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.